Welcome to Narcisse Bible Study. This November 3rd, 2018. Very interesting passage we have before us. So, a couple of new faces. I will just say that we are reading through the parasha, which is portions of the first five books of the Bible. Today, every synagogue in the world reads through a certain portion every week, so that they complete in 1 year reading through all five books. But in Jesus' day, there was a more, there was slower paced, much smaller portions, and they connected with different prophetic portions. So we're trying to follow this older, what we call parasha, and it would normally take three and a half years for us. I think we've already put in that time, and we're still in the book of Numbers. But we are soon completing the book of Numbers, and we will get to recap a little bit, and then around New Year's, we should be beginning our last book, Deuteronomy. So part of the reason we do this is to follow in Jesus' footsteps. We want to discuss the texts that Jesus and his disciples would have been talking about. And the very fascinating thing for us, also as followers of Jesus, is that the older parasha was connected to a different haftarah. Because naturally, when you slow down and you have a different focus, your connections to the prophetic texts will be different. And so you find texts in the older parasha, like Isaiah 53, Isaiah 55, certain texts that just simply do not appear in today's parasha. And there are reasons for that. It is not accidental. So it's just beautiful to dig back to the deeper, or to the more original parasha, because it's more revealing and strengthening of some of these texts that have been ignored by later generations. So our particular text today is not as exciting as others, but it's still always exciting to dig in and see what we can get from it. We're looking at Numbers 31, verse 25 to 54. And I call this the main dish. If you're at a restaurant, this is your main dish. And then the dessert is Isaiah 49, verse 24. And you may remember that we have actually looked at this. We've had the same dessert before with a different dinner during our parashot. So that's interesting. But they had every reason to bring this dessert back again, and we will get there. Another thing we've noticed, maybe we'll talk about in a recap more, is in all these readings, there has been such an emphasis on, one, on Isaiah, which is very typical for Second Temple Judaism in Jesus' time. People were very focused. If you look at all the allusions in the Gospels and the New Testament, you're going to have a predominance of the book of Isaiah. Also, Psalms. Psalms was taken as prophetic in many little passages. Deuteronomy is also popular. So there are certain key books. And it's similar in Qumran. You have a preponderance of certain books. Anyway, so we've had a lot of Isaiah passages. We have also had a lot of passages focused on Jerusalem, which has been very interesting. I think maybe the first 2 years, it's like every week, it's like, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. So very, very interesting. And here we are in Jerusalem discussing these texts. Appropriately so. Very happy to have some distinguished, I'm almost going to say guests. It's very nice to have David Biven here this morning. I know you're at the other end of the table, but make sure you speak up when you do so the microphone gets your pearls of wisdom. Okay, so we begin by reading through. Everyone takes a few verses. First, we're going to read through the Numbers 31 text and discuss it a bit on its own. And then we're going to see how it connects to Isaiah 49 and try to see what we can take away for ourselves from it. So, Gemma, I'll have you start. If you don't have English in front of you, just tap the person next to you and we'll just carry on. Go ahead.
Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Count up the plunder that was taken of man and beast, you and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts between those who took part in the war, who went out to battle, and all the congregation, and levy a tribute for the Lord on the men of war who went out to battle, one of every 500 of the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar, the priest, as a heave offering to the Lord. And from the children of Israel's half, you shall take one of every 50, drawn from the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, the sheep, from all the livestock, and give them to the Levites, who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So Moses and Eleazar, the priest, did as the Lord commanded Moses.
The booty remaining from the plunder which the men of war had taken was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all, women who had not known a man intimately, and the half, the portion for those who had gone out to war, was in number 337,500 sheep,
of which Adonai's tribute was 675, 36,000 cattle, of which Adonai's tribute was 72, 30,500 donkeys, of which Adonai's tribute was 61, and 16,000 persons, of whom Adonai's tribute was 32 persons. Moshe gave the tribute set apart for Adonai to Eleazar the Kohen, as Adonai had ordered Moshe.
From the Israelites' half share that Moses had separated from the fighting men, there were 337,500 sheep from the portion belonging to the community, 36,000 donkeys, 36,000 cattle, 30,500 donkeys, and 16,000 people. From the Israelites' share, Moses took one of every 50 people and animals and gave them to the Levites who were responsible for the care of the Lord's tabernacle, just as the Lord commanded Moses.
This is 48, huh?
Yeah.
And there's the officers who were over the thousands of the army, the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds, came near to Moses and said to Moses, Your servants have counted the men of war who are under our command, and there is not a man missing from us. And we have brought the Lord's offering, what each man found, articles of gold, armlets and bracelets, signet rings, earrings and beads, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. And Moses and Eleazar, the priest, received from them the gold, all crafted articles, and all the gold of contribution that they presented to the Lord. For the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds was 16,750 shekels. The men in the army had each taken plunder for himself. And Moses and Eleazar, the priest, received the gold from the commanders of thousands and of hundreds and brought it into the temple meeting as a memorial for the people of Israel before the Lord.
Sorry, excuse me.
We're done.
Okay. A lot of numbers of things. It's a rather small portion, and yet there are plenty of questions for us. As I was preparing, I wasn't always as careful to write down my references. But dividing the plunder into two for those who stayed behind and those who go out, what does this remind you of? Who else does this later?
David,
yeah. And from David's time on, it becomes law. But this is kind of a precursor to that law. Like there was already a custom of doing this that was fair. But before we get there, Let's talk about first, what type of war is this? What really is this all about?
It's the war against Midian.
War against Midian.
Which was really to reestablish the righteousness of Israel.
Or, what it mentions vengeance. If you go,
yeah,
that was, we talked
week.
About this last week. You go a couple verses back. Yeah. So it's a vengeance over what? Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have been sick for a while and I'm still not better. So sorry to all those who have to listen to me cough. So this is a special war. It's not a normal war, and it's certainly not a conquest war. There are several things in the text that are quite different. First of all, Tada, thank you.
Hey, welcome.
Ani hola. I've just given my excuse. Please, there are plenty of chairs over there. Just grab them and spread them out. We weren't sure how many would come, and so we didn't do it in advance. Aharim yavo'u yoter mo'har? So we are in Numbers 31, for those who just joined us, talking about the aftermath of this war with Midian. So the war with Midian was for vengeance only. And the question is, vengeance from what? And if you remember, at Bilam's advice, which is never actually written in the text, but we see the results of it, is that the Midianite women would lead the Israelites away from God, bringing them into their sacrifice, into their own religion. And so have this combination of sexual immorality with idolatry. And maybe that was a pathway to it. First you seduce them, and then you bring them into the offerings, which probably fertility cults also involved sexual practices. So there was an easy crossover there. And that's what made it so dangerous. But thinking about the Midianites, it's also interesting, because who is Moses' father-in-law?
Jethro.
Who is Jethro?
A Midianite.
Not just a Midianite.
He's
a priest of Midian. Very interesting, yeah? And so Moses married a priest's daughter. A priest of Midianite's daughter. So, fascinating things here. It is still true that the Midianites receive vengeance because of their national actions. However, there are individuals within the Midianites who come under Israel. We see Jethro's relationship to Moses. His whole life long was positive. If you look after the Amalekites attacked in chapter 18, Jethro comes to meet Moses. And if you compare, I'm back in Exodus. Exodus 17, 9 through 16 is the first attack of Amalek, which is like it's the very first enemies of Israel, and there's no reason given why they attack. And you can contrast this immediately afterwards. Yitro, the Midianite, Jethro the Midianite comes. And instead of war, it's peaceful. He comes to greet him. He comes to acknowledge everything God has done for Israel instead of disacknowledge and try to break the covenant. Welcome.
They pushed us up here.
Hi. Come in. Just grab chairs back there, and you can line them up against the back. How many are you?
Eight.
Fine. There's room. So Exodus 18 really gives us a very positive picture of Jethro and the Midianites. And it's one where the Amalek came just to destroy Israel. The Midianites actually come to help. And Jethro gives advice to Moses. And Moses takes that advice and it helps him. So we see there's kind of like, you could almost call it a treaty. It's peaceful. And if you follow the Kenites, Keni, throughout the Bible, they connect with the Judites. They are B'nai B'rit. They are sons of the covenant. They're peaceful with Judites. And Keni is connected to Midian as well. And in fact, the war in Judges, Deborah and Barak and Sisera, they tell the Keni to get out of the way because, hey, you guys are our friends. We want to attack, you know, the Canaanites. And so you see this relationship that they're actually seconded to Judah and the people of Israel. And yet here, you get the opposite side of a terrible national problem, because this problem is up there, I would say, with the golden calf. It was a serious, serious blight. What happened to the people after Baal Peor? What happened to them? We read it a couple weeks ago.
They lived happily ever after?
No. A plague broke out, right?
Right.
And that's how Pinhas, who was so full of a righteous vengeance for God, he went out and he stabbed the Midianite and the Hebrew man. And that was kind of like symbolic for what was going on everywhere. And then everyone who had been involved in this sin was basically killed. Everyone in the plague, either by the plague or by the swords of other people with Pinhas, everyone was killed. And then in this war with Midian, also, Moses is upset that they left the women who had been involved in this idolatry / sexual immorality alive. Normally, in war, women could be plunder. But in this case, he's saying, don't you dare take plunder the very people who incited this on us. And so he makes sure that everybody, this is what we talked about last week, you can look back in Numbers 30. He makes sure that everybody involved basically dies. They're purged from the people. And those left alive are the ones who didn't have anything to do with it yet.
So, Sharon, what comes through this text is this word plunder.
Mm-hmm.
Plunder in my head is bad. But in fact, we're not here.
Well, okay. So we're going to talk about the different words for plunder in a second. And it's interesting, all the words we have for it. One thing to remember is our culture is not the same today as their culture.
That's right.
So you have to put yourself back in an ancient mind frame. What is considered good and bad in those days? So when you go to war, you are allowed to take plunder in general. That is not a bad thing. How you do it, who you do it to, all of these, there can be rules about it. We're going to read them. But compared to that time and that understanding, the worldview, taking people plunder is not something bad.
And the women that were part of the division for the Lord to the to Aaron's, you know, the Levites, would they have been also, you know, wives, or would they serve? How they would serve in the temple? So
the ones taking plunder
for the Lord.
Well, I don't know. It depends. Maybe they would. If they're considered fit. There is a tzovot in the tabernacle, hatzovot, and we don't really know what the function, whether those are people or, you know, in Hebrew, all words are masculine or feminine, right? So tzovot is the one serving or the ones making war. Could go be either way. It could be a person or a thing. So what the Tzov Ot are, there's different interpretations. But one is that there are women who are doing some type of service in the temple. I don't know. So, but certainly they could be household slaves.
Right,
they could be concubines. There are many, many ways captive women can be fit in to the world. But okay, so to keep in mind, this war is a war of vengeance because of what Midian did against the people of Israel. And to oppose Israel is opposing God, basically, in this the same as Amalek. Amalek was wiped out or vowed to be wiped out because of attacking Israel for no reason. And then Midian also, has kind of a similar vengeance taken on them. And things particular to this, you notice Joshua doesn't go out and fight with this selection of people who fight Midian, because Joshua is called to bring the people into the possession of their land. So he's not going to go out and do this vengeance war. He's actually going to take people into Canaan, to Canaan. And how many people go out and fight in this war? We just read it.
It's all numbers.
It's all numbers. And the numbers are a little weird. But what does our selection start with? They're going to count the heads. They're going to lift up the heads, which can be an idiom for several things, but here it's taking a census.
1,000 from every tribe.
1,000 from every tribe. How many tribes are there?
12.
12. So we're talking about 12,000 people that are chosen to go out. And it doesn't include some of the leaders. It doesn't include Joshua. So it's kind of like, it's a very small amount when you think about it. And especially if you look at the numbers of who they bring back. How many virgin women do they bring back?
32,000.
And of course, they killed a whole bunch of other ones. How many people from Israel died in this war?
I think none.
None. Zero.
Not a man of us is missing, it says.
Yeah.
Verse 49.
Yes. So that seems quite miraculous. That 12,000 go out against a whole people, and all 12,000 come back, and the spoils and plunder they receive are way more than they even number. So it seems like this is very much a special war. This is God enacting his vengeance through several people. And it's not a normal war, certainly, and it doesn't seem to follow the normal guidelines. Okay, and we have a very detailed description of the tribute that's given to God after this war. And it tends to work out to a fifth, like everything's according to percentages. And it's also interesting to me that their people are part of this gift to God. And donkeys are part of this gift to God. And what does that tell us? If there's people and donkeys included, it means they're not being sacrificed. Because God doesn't like the sacrifice of people or donkeys. Donkeys are tame. They are unclean, not to be sacrificed. Bakar and Tzon, the cattle, the big cattle, the cows and the sheep, they are fit for sacrifice. Presumably not all of them, because if you're numbering them, you know, there might be some within them that aren't perfect or without blemish. But certainly within the Tzon and Bakar, you're going to expect that some will be actually sacrificed. But not all the tribute is sacrificed, but it is all given to God. So therefore, the practical way that this works out is it's given to the temple, the temple service. You need people lifting things, carrying wood, water. You need donkeys for work. You need people for work. So these people given are going to be dedicated to God. They're not going to be sacrificed. In case you were reading and were feeling uncomfortable. And they are going to go to the Lord's service in the tabernacle. So it's...
Is it for service? I mean, if I'm a... I don't know about a donkey, but if I was a person who's been taken as booty mm-hmm. and then given to the temple... I mean, I'm not going to get sacrificed, but I'm told this is what you're going to do. It's like you're a slave in the situation, aren't you?
You are a slave, yes.
Right.
But at least you're a slave to God.
Right.
Yeah, no, if you look at it on the individual level, it doesn't seem fair sometimes. But on the national level, it's what you call it, poetic justice.
But you could, I mean, I don't want to spiritualize it, but could say that we always have a choice between are we a slave to the enemy, are we a slave to the false
right.
gods, are we a slave to Midian in this case?
Right.
Or are we a slave to the true
so
God?
So better to be a slave to the true God
That's
than
right.
to be free worshipping
yeah.
false gods,
yeah.
for sure. Yeah.
But in the case, Paul says that we don't have a choice. We're either slaves to unrighteousness or slaves to righteousness.
Yeah,
well,
whether we know
choice.
It or not.
You have the choice of which you're going to be. You're not an
No, he's saying either way you're serving somebody.
That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You have the choice. You're either
Someone
one
wrote
or the
a song
other.
About that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got to serve somebody.
Where's that written?
It's a very nice song.
In
Look it up for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've got a question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm baffled by... say verse 40 of 31, it says that the persons were 16,000 and the Lord's tribute was 32 persons. What does the Lord's tribute mean?
It was a type of tithe, if
mm-hmm.
I could use that. So how, I mean, first of all, they also differentiate in this passage between priests and Levites. So I don't know that we know exactly what the difference would have been between everything given to the priests and everything given to the Levites. Like those 32 people set aside for the Lord, how, like what then was their function?
But it's not that 32 person, even with my mathematical brain, 32 persons is not a tithe of 16,000.
No, these are actually, if you break it down, it's more like fifths. It's more like fifths.
One out of 50 from the 16,000 would be 320.
And, well, what one thing is one out of 500 and one is one out of 50. Right?
So one out of 500 was the...
From the Israelites' half share, you are to take out 50... One portion out of 50, and then and the other one.
So one out of 500 was the tribute, but one out of 50 was given to the Levites. Is that right? On that verse?
Yes. Yeah. But it's still, it's obviously, it's very small considering how the question still remains open, how these people were set apart specially. Like, what then happened to them? What did they actually do for the Lord? How was this a gift to the Lord? Because we know he doesn't want human sacrifice. And also the donkeys. There's 61 donkeys. So are these the special donkeys that carry the Holy of Holy things? Or are these the people? I don't know. It doesn't tell us. But there was some type of... It's like there are levels of gifts.
How many donkeys were there?
61. Very important. Okay.
It is called Numbers, this book we're studying.
It is called Numbers. And the numbers are staggering. They don't always make sense. But within, they are coordinated with each other in the book of Numbers. So that's a nice thing. Within itself, it makes sense. Hi. Welcome. Okay. Now, what happens when you take account of people? Is taking a census a good thing or a bad thing?
Depends whether you were told to do it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, in general, you could almost say it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Because it's considered to be prideful, or like, look how many people I have. Or maybe it's a dangerous thing, because you're focusing too much on your strength. However, there are times where God commands it. But it's interesting because here you have a gift that is said to be atoning. And so the question is, what is the atonement for? Is it for the fact that you've taken a census? Let me find the verse we're talking about. Where are we talking about? Sure, that is fine.
Try to say that, no, the gallery. I think we lost. We lost. Or we gained.
Thank you for letting us part of
this. Sure. So, Numbers 31, if you look in verse 50. So, we've brought a sacrifice to God, each man what he found. Items of gold, bracelets, rings, earrings, pendants, to atone for our lives before the Lord. So what is the atonement for? It's interesting because, let's see, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. Some people would say this is an expression of thanksgiving, but if it's only thanksgiving, you really don't need to say atone. Atonement is covering something that was lacking, that was, and so you have two options. It could be the fact that they shed blood, where they're saying we want to atone for ourselves, and that would tie into this being a holy war. Like, it has nothing to do with us. We're not fighting them to get their land. We're not trying to do anything of our own. We were simply enacting the Lord's vengeance on them. So that's one interpretation. The other one could be atonement for taking a census. Because sometimes after you take a census, a plague breaks out. And it's a scary thing. They don't want that to happen, so they're saying, look, this is atonement in the sense of...
Where did they take the census? How do we know? I mean,
they counted all the heads. That's what our parasha begins with. That
right.
Now, in this case, God actually told them to take a census. So, you think if God tells you, it's not going to bring a plague. But if you have the understanding that you know taking a census is usually not a good thing, you could kind of like to show that we weren't doing this out of our own accord. Here is atonement.
It says count up the plunder. Does it actually talk about count? To me, a census is counting the people.
Yeah,
and
the people
David
who went out.
He gets into trouble, or somebody.
Well, it can be counting people. It can be counting armies.
And counting up the plunder, the what you've got in, all the good the stuff you've got. You think that's the same?
Well, they're related, let's say. Okay. What was your point, Sheila?
They weren't counting the available people. They were counting, the Lord decided how many would go into this battle. Like he did before when he cut it down.
Right, from
so
Gideon.
He's sending out really few, considering it's a whole people, mm-hmm. and they're coming back without anyone missing.
Yeah. And in this case, I think that's part of it. that they needed to take the census to realize what a miracle it was, that everybody actually came back. That's a very miraculous war where everyone goes out and nobody dies. So in that sense, maybe there's a reason for God asking them to count. But the individuals in that army may not know or realize. Yeah, so in any case, they offer gifts as an atonement. Now let's look at the different words for plunder, because this is important for our selections today. So we don't have a lot of time, but I'm just going to throw some up there. We have malkoach.
You know what? I see some people learning Hebrew here, so I'm going to write in this script. Malkoach. We have Shri.
Shalal.
Shlal and Baz.
Now, a lot, basically, all of the words. Oh, let me just write this in English too.
Is that last one bar? Is it a resh at the end?
Baz.
Oh, it's bad.
Baz.
Baz is who?
Basically, this selection has all the words for plunder. Now, in English, how many words can you give me? We have plunder, spoils,
booty,
loot, what?
Prey.
That's a nice one, too. Okay, I'm just going to write them. Plunder.
Swag.
Loot.
Swag.
Yeah, very good.
Wait, what about from down here?
Spoils.
What else?
Swag?
Okay, I'm not sure. That must be a pirate one. This is in English, and I'm sure other languages have words too. I can't actually tell you the difference between any of these words in English. They have a different feel, maybe.
There's a little difference.
I'm sure there are, because they all exist.
Yeah.
And languages don't want two words that are identical. They need to differentiate a bit.
400 years ago.
But spoils. You know, that's an interesting one, because
you're talking about the spoils.
Vegetables spoil, that means they're rotten. The spoils are good stuff, you know, so that's a strange word to use. I think
you talk about the spoils of war.
Spoils of war. It's very particular to war. If you use that word outside of war, it means rotten.
Yeah.
But in war, it's the best, it's the stuff that remains,
right.
You know. So every language has connotations with all these words. That's my point. And in Hebrew, we have a bunch of words as well, and they all have their own connotations, some of which we know and maybe some of which we don't know. Yes, so of course you're thinking to Isaiah, who names his child Maher Shalal, this one, Hashbaz. So he has these two in parallel. Maher is fast, Hash is to do something quickly. So fast and quick.
Speedy to the spoil.
Quick to the plunder. Or speedy to the spoil, quick to the booty.
No, you get something else that rhymes, and then you can argue that it was written in English first.
David, where's the text? Where's the text?
That's Isaiah 8, but we'll... Let's start... I just wanted to give you... You know what? I didn't write out the numbers... For Baz, or did I? No, I didn't. Baz is harder to find, to make a quick search of just the noun, because we have a lot of verbs to plunder. 53 of what?
Of 31. Numbers 31, 53 is Baz.
Is Baz, right. No, I'm saying overall in the Bible. Because what I want to do, this word malkoach comes from kach, to take. Lakahat, we all know that word, right? So this is a noun for that word. The takings. How many times do you think that word comes in the Bible?
Often.
No?
Which?
Once.
But not once, but
or
few.
Twice.
Seven times in the Bible. So this is a pretty rare word when you're talking about differentiating between your words. And that's going to be significant. Shevi, or Shvi, is more common. It's 50 times. Shalal is 74 times. Baz, I didn't count yet, but it's going to be quite a few times. 27 as just Baz, but there's also Biza. Biza is another noun derived from this same root. So combined, probably many more references. It's probably more than the category. And there's a verb used a lot, yeah. So I would say in terms of overall feel, all of these are used quite often. This one is kind of more exceptional. But in our passage alone, we've got them all, which is great. So I'm just going to put 27 here, plus. Okay. So let's look at some of the other ones first. To be captive. Okay. Shvi. To go into captivity. What are we talking about here? People. I think this is important. You can refer, maybe all of these can refer to people, but out of all of these, I would say this one specifically refers to people. You're talking about going into captivity. The first time we see this in the Bible is Exodus 12:29, that talks about the plague of the firstborn that affects the firstborn of Pharaoh all the way down to the firstborn of the captives who are sitting in the prisons. So that gives you the whole range of the highest in society to the lowest in society. Even the captives, yeah.
No, cattle, the firstborn of the cattle.
Right? Oh, even the firstborn of the cattle, yeah. Okay, so
even
captive, the
animals
go into captivity with the people.
And the people who are in prison could even have them, Israelites.
Sure, I mean, Joseph essentially goes to Egypt and ends up in prison.
So that's pretty...
Basically, yeah. Fugitives, you oftentimes end up in prison if you're a foreigner. Now, I wanted to look at Deuteronomy 21, because that's significant. Because it gives us some rules about captivity. Okay, wait, 21 or 20, what am I doing here? Okay, now that is a homicide victim, wait. Hold on. Okay, go back, Deuteronomy 20. It says, when you go out for war against your enemy and you see a horse or a chariot, don't be afraid of them because God's with you. Okay. And then it gives you a whole bunch of rules for how you do warfare in the right way. Now again, God says, when you do this, it's not necessarily a command to do it. When you do this, this is how you should do it. And in many of these these commandments, if you compare them to the ancient Near East, you find that the Bible's commandments have a higher sense of justice and a higher sense of value to people and things. Now, but notice in verse 13. So this is when you come against the city and the Lord delivers it to you. You must kill every single male by the sword. However, the women, little children, cattle, and anything else in the city, all its plunder you may take for yourselves as spoil. And there is the first plunder is shalal. And so is the second one. So why did they change from plunder to spoil? I'll tell you why. English, we don't like to use the same word twice. We think that's ugly. You have to find a synonym. Where Hebrew, we like to use the same word twice. If you're happy, a big happy. If you fear, a big fear. This is beautiful in Hebrew. Where English, we want to use, you know, mix it up a bit. So here, it's the same word twice.
And the word is buzz.
No, shalal.
Oh, sorry.
One says spoil and booty and spoil and shalal.
Yeah.
Verse 14.
Okay, so the verb they're using is to take booty with tavoz. It's from the same word, the root is baz. But the noun is shalal. And eat all the shlal oivecha, the shalal of your enemy that God's given to you. Okay. Now that is like normal warfare. And then it goes, but the warfare that God's giving you as an inheritance, then you wipe out everything. That's a different level. And specifically in verse 18, so that they don't teach you the abhorrent ways they worship their gods, causing you to sin against the Lord your God. So in a sense, Midian is somewhere in between these two things. It is not land meant to be inherited by Israel, but they did try to teach Israel ways of worshiping false gods and leading them away from God. And that's why there is more of a wipeout than usual. Okay. Let's see. Deuteronomy 28:41. Okay. There are other references. If you think of Deuteronomy 21, you have the curses where God says, choose life or death. He's making a treaty with Israel. And if you don't follow the treaty, there are certain consequences. And then there's a whole list of pretty bad consequences, which we call blessings and curses. And one of them, if you look at Deuteronomy 28:41, is that your sons and your daughters that you have won't be yours, but they will go into captivity. So it's kind of a futility curse. Like even if you have a bunch of sons and daughters, you won't get anything from it because they'll be taken away from you. So that's just an example of this shvi word. Taken into captivity. And of course, we have plenty of mention of captivity elsewhere in the Bible. So this includes people. Let's also look at shalal. Exodus 15:9 has the song of the sea after they cross the Red Sea. And it says, the enemy says, I will chase, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. That's shalal. I will draw my sword, my hand will destroy them. So part of conquering, part of being victorious is seen as, you know, taking the spoil. And of course, we had the special, we already read Deuteronomy 20 about the special instructions regarding spoil when it's a holy war. And In some cases, you may not take the spoil. It needs to be burned up completely. In other cases, it needs to be given to God. Let's see, Deuteronomy 13:7 I have written down.
So what you're saying is that there's a whole bunch of different wars. So you've got a holy war. You've got a vengeance war. But that's a holy war.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with the...
With the significance?
Well, what we know, what you're saying, is that in every war, there is spoil.
Yeah.
And if you've got spoil, basically it's a sign of victory. But what happens to that spoil will depend on what the war
what
was.
What kind of war it was,
what,
yeah,
what
definitely.
War it was.
Whether you can keep things alive or have to destroy them.
Right.
So, to me, there's three categories you can have in spoil. You can have people, you can have animals, and you can have treasures like gold and silver, fine linen, clothes. And in some types of wars, it all has to be gotten rid of. Some things you can keep from some and not others. And in each case, I guess you need to know. But if you think of these categories, shalal, I would say you're normally referring to stuff, like the gold and silver. However, it is kind of generic. And if you look at Judges 5:30, you have a picture, the poet is giving you a picture of what the enemy is saying. This is Sisera's war. He comes in and he thinks he's going to get a womb or two. Rechem rachmatayim. In other words, a woman. And then that's paralleled with an embroidered thing or two. Rikma rikmatayim. So it's almost like he's viewing all the spoils like a woman is an object, basically, in this. Raham, you're right. So it's a word for a young woman, but with the idea of based on the word for womb. So it's very.
Where's that Judges one?
Judges 5:30. But here, I think in Judges 5:30, that this is showing you a typical attitude after war. I get the spoils, and it's comparing the women just as if they were the other stuff to be used. Oh, I get some embroidered cloth. I get some women. Yeah. Which list are you looking at, please?
Numbers 31.
Okay, Numbers 31, verse 22.
It has iron. This is normally thought of as a little bit early. The age would be a little bit early for what we call the Iron Age. So I'm wondering if what you've heard discussions on this and if it could be some kind of special things, not just like swords, but some kind of special, ornaments or tools or something, sort of before iron became used as a common tool.
That it still existed in small amounts, is what you're saying?
Randall, where are you?
Say your verse again, I don't see it.
And neither do I. Numbers 31, 32.
22.
22.
So right before our selection.
31:22. So anyway, I was just wondering if you had heard discussion about the iron here.
I may have. Nothing stands out in my memory.
I don't remember anything.
However, it could be that there's a list and it was filled in subsequently. Because the emphasis here is anything that can go through fire can be purified that way. And so they're just making the list to include everything possible. not remembering that at that time they didn't have certain of those elements. I don't know. It's possible.
You can't put lead through fire, can you?
But why am I making us go through this arduous journey of what Bodhi could be, what it is or isn't? And really, I think the important part, we just need to go to Isaiah 49:24, because we're going to get hit in the face with one of these words. Isaiah 49, verse 24. Okay.
Shall the prey be taken from the mighty?
Okay, we start right in the rhetorical question. Hayukach migibo malkoach? Will the takings be taken from the victor? Or you say, will the prey, can the spoils be taken from a warrior? It's this word, malkoach. Ve'im shvi tzadik yimalet. And would the captive of the righteous escape? And here, there's a contextual thing. In Qumran, we have, instead of righteous, we have mighty man, or reckless person, aritz, and not tzaddik. They aren't actually graphically very similar, but we do have, in the same verse, those two parallels come back. However, you know, there can be arguments made for the Masoretic text.
I've got captives of the mighty should be taken away.
Yeah, you do, and that means your translation looked at that and said, you know what, Qumran has a more logical manuscript tradition, so we're going to go with that instead of the Masoretic text. Verse 24, our very
25.
Verse we... 25? 24.
Oh, well, then I've got 25, all the captives of the righteous should be delivered. Wait a minute.
No, it's verse 24.
24 is righteous, tzaddik.
Yeah,
right.
Or captives be rescued from a conqueror. That word conqueror there in the Masoretic text says righteous, tzaddik. But in Qumran, in Isaiah's scroll, 1Q Isaiah A, it reads aritz there and not tzaddik. Why should the prey of the righteous be rescued? Well, you could take it to be tzaddik, a justified war. So this, if you view it as the parallelism, the one is supplying extra elements that explain the first, saying, can you take away the booty from the one who is conquered? And especially if their conquering is justified, is any of their captives going to be able to escape? And the rhetorical question says no. Or you can go with Qumran text and say, you know, basically, if they conquered, they get to keep what they conquered. That's just standard practice.
So
yeah.
In my text, in the Hebrew, verse 24 is tzaddik.
Yes.
Verse 25 is aritz.
That's right. So you can say tzaddik was a mistake and it should have been aritz. Or you can say maybe tzaddik was meant to be there and there's a developmental understanding. Mm-hmm.
Could be a play of words.
Possibly. Or possibly this idea that this battle is justified. Because aritz in the book of Proverbs is not so good. It's kind of a ruthless person.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be a good or a bad, you know, where tzaddik is definitely good.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that this is close, what is written?
Aritz is written in both those places,
oh.
Both in verse 24 and 25. Mm-hmm. So it's a textual matter to weigh. Okay, so you could go that way.
The prophecy in Zechariah where the king comes in and it says that he is tzaddik v'nosha.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like victorious and
vindicated.
And vindicated, having salvation, victory.
Right.
Sahib,
but also, the world view is that the king is in charge of meting out justice, both in legal spheres and in conquering, you know. So even there you could see both interpretations of a justice, a righteousness, and a, you know, victorious. There's a little bit of an overlap there using the word Sadiq. But then God continues in verse 25. Indeed, says the Lord, captives will be taken from a warrior. Spoils will be rescued from a conqueror. I don't know if I would go with that. Ki cho amar Adonai, gam shvi gibo yukach, umalkoach aritz yimalet, ve'et yirivecha anochi ariv, ve'et banecha anochi oshia. To me, it almost seems like even if this happens, I will contend with your contenders. I will save your children.
That's what I have in
That's
mind.
Kind of even if?
Can I read it?
Okay.
Even the captives of the mighty should be taken away, and the prey of the terrible be delivered. But I will contend with him who contends with you,
okay.
And I will save your children.
So in my translation here with the net, it says, indeed, captives will be taken from a warrior, spoils will be rescued from a conqueror. I will oppose your adversary, and I will rescue your children. And he continues, I will make your oppressors eat their own flesh. They will get drunk on their own blood as if it were wine. The word there is the sweet new wine, asis. And I guess it would be easier to get drunk on sweet new wine because it's sweet and so you can drink more of it. So that's a pretty gruesome description. But what are we looking at here? What is our big connection? This prey, this word for plunder. Out of the seven times in the Bible that this word exists, can you guess where they are? We read three of them in our parasha, and, or four, I don't know, the remainder are in this section of Isaiah. Now think to yourself, if you were reading this selection in Numbers, and someone said, oh, come up with a portion of the prophets that suits this, how many of us could do this without a concordance?
And a computer.
It is absolutely amazing
search, yeah.
That this word connects these two places, because it's only so few times in the Bible, the only places it occurs are in this context and in this context. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, to me, it challenges me to know the Bible to that level, that, because after all, how do we interpret the Bible? We often use the Bible to interpret the Bible. And so you have to be able to connect passages. And sometimes those connections are poetic. They can be all types of connections. But in thinking about them together, it usually brings to light different aspects of them.
So,
Hine. Yes. So there's three times in this passage. Sorry, five times. And two times here in these two verses.
So what's the connection between the Midianites and the Isaiah passage?
So the interesting thing is there's a flip, because the Midianites, God is discussing what to do with these captives from a war that was his vengeance. Well, it's actually kind of similar. And here, the captives are the Israelites themselves. But they are going to be vindicated and brought back because of God's mercy. I'm going to oppose your adversary, and I'm going to rescue your children. So this is, you know, after the exile, God's going to bring them back. And it goes on to say that, you know, the kings, where is it? The kings are going to bring, why can't I just see what's in front of my face? Sometimes that's the hardest thing. Here we are. Go back a verse or two. I will raise my hand to the nations. I will raise my signal flag to the peoples. It's a nes. I'm going to put a nes la'amim. They will bring your sons in their arms and carry your daughters on their shoulders. Kings will be your children's guardians. Their princesses will nurse your children. So all these captives, all these children that have been taken away into exile are going to be offered back as tribute. They're going to be returned. This is something that doesn't happen on human terms. Thus the rhetorical question, can spoils be taken from a warrior? Like if they won fair and square, they took the captives, how on earth could we get them back? And the answer is only because of God. That God will oppose the adversary and will rescue the children. And I think the tie-in for me is also God does this. He opposes the enemy of Israel. And if you look at the war with Midian, it was really a vengeance from God. It wasn't the people's own thing. It was from God. And he was the one that caused nobody to fall. And there are all these special rules for this war because it was seen as a vengeance of God. And in the same way, from the exile, because of God, in God's covenant, he's going to bring these children back who were led into captivity. And you could argue, justly so, because they had left the covenant with God. And however, God is going to judge the people who took them into captivity and make them bring them back. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is the two connecting things is those who oppose Israel are actually opposing God. And don't take these words too simplistically and just apply them to today. Think about them and the covenant God had with Israel. Because there's nothing magical here. It's a covenant relationship that's going on, and it's God honoring his covenant and being faithful to it. So who exactly Israel is, that's a big, big question. But certainly God's covenant stands. That's what we know for sure. And he is the one that makes it stand and honors it no matter what. Even when Israel leaves it, you know, he brings them back. So that all humankind, in verse 26, will recognize that I am the Lord, your deliverer, your protector, the powerful ruler of Jacob, or Avir Yaakov. Okay, so that's all we have time for today. Again, these texts are very outside of our worldview and outside of our personal experience. But we can chew on them anyway and take away that we want to align ourselves with God and God's people. And we want to be encouragers of the covenant. And careful to keep it. So Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.